Hi, it's Jacob here from the High Performance Property Investment Podcast. Today we're joined by Damien Brander. He is the Managing Director of the Australian Lending and Investment Centre, someone that we work really closely with, someone that I hold at the absolute top of the industry in terms of knowledge, depth of knowledge, how they support clients end to end throughout their investment journey, and someone that I think we have some really interesting chats on this topic today, which is finance. How can we maximise our borrowing capacity? How can we treat finance and investment finance like a longer term strategy, one property moving into the next? And also, what is Damien's number one opportunity that he feels is presented to us as investors in this market today? So lots of great content to unpack. Thank you so much for joining us today, Damien.
No worries, and thanks, Jacob, for having me on board. And it probably would be remiss of me not to give you a little bit about my background and sort of what's led me to becoming the Managing Director of the ALIC. So I began a journey in the banking industry about 17 years ago. I began at the very grassroots, working in a business centre and doing business banking helpline many years ago for the National Australia
wow.
Bank.
But that's fun.
It was a great environment to learn and to be developed, and I got to work with some really fantastic leaders who believed in me. And so very quickly I became a branch manager, which then led to being a senior personal banker, and then I was a bank manager of one of the second largest branches for the National Australia Bank at St Kilda Road, and then ultimately led to an area manager role at the Bank West as they were expanding across the east coast of Australia. It's basically like building a brand new bank all over again. And then I had the very fortunate opportunity to do that again with Bank of Melbourne when they first opened back in 2011, and pretty much set up the SME business banking team there, myself and a couple of my colleagues actually really developing that whole business model over the course of the next 9 years. So, you know, really broad and sort of varied experience in the banking sector across 3 to 4 different banks. And then ultimately coming over to the Australian Lending Investment Centre at its heart, which was all about, you know, how do you really sort of help sophisticated borrowers know and understand and be a bit more educated around the whole sort of, you know, mortgage market, because it is becoming a lot more complex at the moment.
It is, and I think we work quite closely. You know, I know that a lot of the financial solutions that ALIC provide to our clients is second to none. It really does help give our clients a lot of clarity, and I really see the level that you're operating at, both yourself and, you know, it's not just yourself as well, Damien, is I think over 70 of you are in the business as well, based out of Melbourne, CBD, so, you know, you're at the top of your game in terms of a business, and I think it comes down to the quality and, I guess, the client focus. And it's not just about, it does have a very close alignment with what we do at Ripe House, and I don't want to focus on this, I wanted to get into the good stuff, but it's not just about buying one property, as we'll talk about today. It really is a game of finance. It is about a strategy to build a portfolio and, empower one purchase into the next. So with that in mind, Damien, just before we jump into the good stuff, high level, you know, questions that you see a lot of people asking at the moment with interest rates increasing, what are three really quick things that people can do to potentially maximise or increase their borrowing capacity right now?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. You've got to go back to the heart of why we're all so fixated on interest rates in the first place, you know. At the heart of it, Australians love property. They love investing in property, and you've got to understand why that is. It's really how the little bloke gets ahead in life, you know. When you think about it, you know, we don't all have the acumen, nor do we have the resources to really invest heavily in the share market early. You know, we typically are all really trying to sort of get our own home and then utilise that equity in some way to continue, you know, enabling wealth creation. And so Australians have got a real love affair with property because it's predominantly the way that, you know, those that are sort of aspiring to sort of, you know, do more and have a better future for themselves get into it. And that's why we're all really fixated on interest rates. And so a lot of people have been asking me, you know, oh, what does it mean with the interest rates going up and should I be worried and all of these things. And we're pretty fortunate that we're dealing with people who, you know, it's probably not their first rodeo. They've had an investment property. They've gone through the cycle of, you know, ups and downs. Not many of us experienced, recent increases. You've got to go back to 2006, 2007 to see this sort of rapid sort of rate increase environment. And that's been quite a while. So, you know, no wonder people still very much are talking about it. But the things that are quite important when you're thinking about interest rates is non-deductible debt versus deductible debt. You know, bank servicing calculators and the way that they're built, you know, it's much more beneficial and it helps a lot more to leverage up and get more access to finance if you have deductible debt. Why? Because interest rates and increasing interest rates are largely offset by the negative gearing benefit and then the added tax back calculation from when you're doing a, you know, servicing model. And so, so it doesn't just support you there, David.
Just to grab you and just elaborate on that, sorry, just to unpack that. So we're talking about, so I guess the idea number one to increase borrowing capacity is to maximize tax deductible debt and minimize non-deductible debt. So non-deductible debt would be things like a car, you know, credit cards, leveraging up to go on a holiday, and even principal place of residence debt. Would that, that's the bucket there for non-deductible debt, whilst deductible debt is, I guess, lending for shares as well, and then lending for investment properties or property. Is that the other buckets as you would define them as well?
Absolutely. And so, you know, one of the sort of common strategies that is used, if you have equity, let's say, in a non-deductible property, okay, now you may decide that you want to leverage some of that equity to get ready for a new purchase, okay? And why is that? Because you just can't walk in and say, I want to buy this $600,000 property. You need to have some form of deposit. You need comfort of having some sort of finance approval or some sort of indication of what your borrowing capacity is. All of these things mean you probably need to prepare yourself. Plus, as most people did, they were probably saving large sums of cash in the COVID period because there was no really to go. You didn't really have any big holidays planned. You couldn't really spend it. So a lot of people, and the whole sort of RBA outlook is based on us saving over nearly 200 million or 200 billion, I think it was, in offset saving balances across the finance sector over the last couple of years. Now, and that gives the RBA comfort about the rate of increases that they've been applying because they're sort of comforted a little bit by the fact that people have offset savings that they can sort of leverage at the moment.
So, to correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the total value of Australian property, residential property, $3 trillion?
It's a lot.
It's $3 trillion. So, I don't have that information in front of me, but off the top of my head, I think it is $3 trillion. So 200 million is about, what, 7%?
Sorry, 200 billion, I think, is the actual number.
200 billion. So we're talking about 7%, you know, across every property in Australia, we've got on average 7% buffer sitting in people's offset accounts. You know, when you're unpacking that, it's not just some people with 7%, it is on average. So some people might be sitting with 20, 30, 40% in their offset facilities. So I guess that's
and
the sort of information.
And some might have a lot more than that too. The astute investor often, I guess, is that you understand that at sometimes it's harder to obtain finance than others. So when times are, let's say, at a low interest rate environment, it's a little bit easier to obtain finance. Investors typically are preparing. They're trying to leverage up and capture as much borrowing capacity as they can during these easier times, more affordable times. And then they're usually parking a lot of that surplus funds that they've just borrowed in offset accounts in preparation for the next investment, the next buying opportunity, or perhaps an opportunity too good to refuse because, hey, there's someone that's actually really needing to sell a property and it's a below market offer and we can get something quickly. So, you know, as the old saying goes, people will often buy in the gloom to sell in the boom, which means, you know, they want to be prepared for those events. So that's where you see some people with more and then obviously with a lot of people with a lot less. But I think one of the key strategies there is how do you leverage equity in the first place and then not necessarily have the impact of the large repayments and the big interest costs. And offsetting is very much the way to do that. And that negates what's happening largely in the interest rate environment. If you've got a $1 million facility and you've parked $1 million of interest or cash in the offset account in preparation for some sort of strategy, you really just need to sort of move money around to make sure you're meeting the minimum repayment set out by the lender. And then you can actually just move it straight back into your offset. It's a little bit of a sort of conundrum there, but you know, that's how people are playing the game a little bit with the lenders to sort of make sure that at the end of the month, there is no actual interest charge. I've 100% offsetted the balance of that loan with cash in the offset account. But I've always got the ability then, when there's a great buying opportunity, to utilize that and get out into the market. Now, if you take that down into what most people probably see is like, I've got maybe a couple of $100,000 worth of equity in that investment property, and I'm thinking perhaps about looking at something else. whether it be shares. I'm predicting that the share market might be a good time to buy, or there's a particular stocks that I'm quite interested in, the bank stocks, for example, because in an increasing interest rate environment, they generally make more revenue, and potentially I want to tap into that. So whatever the reason is, people want to leverage that equity, and how they go about that can be through some sort of lending strategy. And it doesn't necessarily mean that by borrowing that extra money that they're going to be impacted by the extra interest costs. Now, when I mean interest costs, if you're electing to have your deductible debt on interest-only terms, if your plan is to principally pay down that loan and then you therefore have it on a principal and interest repayment structure, that's your plan and that's fine. But for investors that are looking at the shorter time frame between 3 to 5 years for an investment to play out, it doesn't make a lot of sense to actually then think about the principal reductions, because over a 30-year loan term, you're not actually going to reduce a lot of the principal balance in the first 5 years. It's not how the amortization schedule works. So what you actually do is you set it as an interest only, and therefore you can offset that clearly. You know exactly what I've got in my offset account and how it exactly then corresponds to the interest that you would be charged. And that gives you more certainty around your cash flow position.
I might just pause you there, Damien, because I think there's some absolute gold in what you've just talked about, and we probably need to unpack a couple of those concepts if that's okay. So, you know, let's park the concept. I think the first point you made was across our net position, across our portfolio, we are always attempting to minimize non-deductible debt and then maximize deductible debt, because that is in this environment, and I think a really important point that you touched on, as interest rates are increasing, well, the cost associated with that asset or that acquisition is interest, that's deductible. So our deductions, our tax deductions are actually increasing as well. So as interest rates are increasing, our tax deductions are increasing as well. It's a really powerful concept to grasp. And then you probably touched on a concept around getting our powder dry, right? So if we've got equity in our investments or our principal place of residences, going and looking at that equity, having some properties revalued potentially, and then having an offset facility set up which encapsulates that equity that you have in your portfolio and sits it there ready to go. So when you are able, and I think this is a very important practice, when you are then, you have that sitting there, you are able to then capitalize on opportunities as they present themselves. And I think that in this environment, the types of properties that we're looking at day to day are very opportunistic purchases. You know, we've got fearful vendors, we've got a little bit of blood in the water, and when we know our research, we back ourselves, we can come in and we can really acquire with some strength. And so what you're talking about is probably very regularly. You know, what sort of time period would you suggest, Damien, that people do review their portfolios, their values, and increase their offset facilities?
Always. Is my
Always.
Answer to that one.
Yeah,
I worked for 17 years in the big four banking sector, and I know enough to know that there is a real need for clients across the whole industry to review their finances regularly. And the reason for that is there is definitely a loyalty tax with a lot of the major lenders. That you do not get the sort of discount bargaining power on an existing client, even from our perspective. You often need to look at what we call front book discounting or front book margin management from the lenders to get a better deal for a client. That's why people go to brokers. You know, 70% of the market now is going through a broker as opposed to going directly through the lender. And there's a good reason for that, because the bargaining power is all on the front book management. It's not on negotiating your existing interest rates. Banks do not give you the same sort of discounting benefit. So you really do need to review your loans often. And having come out of, you know, a long period of time in the banks, I've begun to see that a hell of a lot more clearly in the past couple of years, just how much more important it is now to actually really have a good line of sight on, are you getting the best deal? Do you have the best sort of structure? Do you have the best loan options at your disposal to help you with your goals? If your goal is to simply pay off your own home, that's fine, but you should still be then thinking about what is the best way to reduce my interest so I can pay it off quicker.
So that would be, you know, you don't describe yourself as a broker, and AOIC doesn't describe themselves as a brokerage business. It's an investment strategist, which is a term, I think it's a very, you know, it's a powerful, I guess, concept to grasp the difference. And this is, I think, you're acting, and this is probably more for the listeners' clarity. You are holding the banks to the account. You know, you at any one time know the lenders, know what discounts have been applied, know the front, you know, forgive me with not knowing the language, the front discounting that can be applied. So would you encourage your clients to contact you, you know, what, every day? Or are we talking every quarter? What would be a time frame where, you know, they'll be contacting and say, look, do we have any equity here, any other loan products we can move into? Or would it be, you know, potentially more of a passive where you would reach out to them when you've done an internal review?
Well, look, clients' lives are busy, and they're busy concentrating on, you know, their careers and earning income. You know, that's what clients should be busy on. They should be focused. Debt and managing debt should not be something they're thinking about all the time. You know, it should be a set and forget, knowing that it's a structure and strategy that's in place for a reason. But what we do with our clients is we're doing a touch base. We have a rolling communications that we have programmed in to touch base with our clients every 4 months. And we do that to give them the sense of comfort that we're always there, that we're always available, that we're ready and able to help them at any point in time if they do need to reset or review their strategy. And often we'll know and press the point, it is time to review your strategy, because your interest rates are probably not what is best in market right now. And you do have some equity given some recent price increases in the sectors that you may be invested in. Now, that depends on the timing and the market, but we're always constantly touching base with our clients to ensure that they know we're there. And that helps us to really sort of become intimate with our client, be intimate with their strategy, and help them, really we're about educating clients how to manage their money much better.
And you touched on the front-ended discounts, and you know, this is not, I'm more talking around at a broker level. You know, the way that the industry is structured, for those, you know, just to probably give some understanding, you've got banks, right? You've got the individual banks. You know, a mum and dad investor can walk in off the street, you know, knock on the door and say, hi, I want to buy an investment property. And you have a bank lender there who will take them through their position, talk through the different products, and, you know, go through that application process. You've then got potentially a mortgage broker. It might be a one-man operation. They may be very experienced, and you know, we definitely respect and know a lot of one-man operations that are extremely good at what we do. And you have some potentially inexperienced as well. They might not. They have a very, I guess, defined panel of lenders that they are, I guess, able to recommend products to. So you have all of the lenders, but they might only be able to offer certain products to their clients, which they have the compliance for. And then on the flip side, they don't really have a huge amount of leverage. If they aren't sort of sending too many clients to that lender, then, you know, the business development managers at that lender, the relationship managers, etc., they might not be moving their clients to the top of the pile. And then you go all the way through to you know, larger brokering businesses or strategist businesses that have a tremendous amount of leverage. And, you know, one of the other partners at AOIC, Kevin, his Kevin Agent, he mentioned to me in passing a couple of weeks ago that he's able, and they're able, or you guys are able to negotiate a 3% discount off the market rate with a tier one lender, and that's for the life of the loan. He did mention that there's a floor in that as well, so it doesn't go into the minus if interest rates do decrease. But, and this might not be specific to you guys as well, but is that something that you're seeing now? And does that exist? And how much leverage do you really have?
That is, you know, you're very much on point there, Jacob. You know, we got as high as 3.11 with the biggest of the big four just recently. And the reason for that is because if you look at what happened during the rate decreasing periods of COVID, the banks did not really lower their standard variable rates. What they did to offset all the noise and all the media attention was increase their front book discounts or their new lending discounts. They increased
dramatically. So that's trying to get people to come in off the street. Let's
correct.
Get a new client on the books.
And
so
what it did was it largely avoided the topical question of why are interest rates so high when the Reserve Bank cash rate is sitting at 0.1. Well, when customers are getting 2.4% or 1.98 fixed rates, there wasn't a lot of need to make noise in the media. But in the at that whole time, the bank standard variable rate, or the SVR, was sitting up around about 5%. And it didn't really change. You know, I think it dropped down to as low as probably 4.8 for some of them. Then they have some other products which are designed with larger discounts in, like their basic loans. Okay, and so they advertise those. And that sort of then said, okay, well, the banks are being fair. They've passed a discount on. But largely they haven't, because anyone sitting on an existing discount, let's say of 1%, which was good maybe 5 years ago, well, they're only sitting at around about 4%, because the SVR is sitting at 5%. So they didn't get any benefits of the rate decreases.
So let me just unpack that. Sorry to interrupt again there. As interest rates were decreasing through the last, you know, cycle, when they got down to, as you say, an introductory rate with a, you know, a new client coming to the tier one, they could be accessing 2% or a very low rate, where the, you know, the client for that bank who's been on the books for 10 years, as interest rates were reduced, 0.25 or 1%, 0.25 or 1%, that wasn't being fully passed on to those existing loan holders. And so that separation between the actual RBA rate and what mums and dads are generally paying as an existing customer just increased dramatically. Is that correct? A correct summary?
Absolutely. And it's hand in hand with what we see. If I give you just a point in time. So when I was working at the National Australia Bank, okay, back in 2006, 2007, and this is in the sort of peak of the mining boom years. Now, a good discount, let's say you had $1.5 million, $2 million loan, the best discount you could negotiate off the SVR was around about 0.9. Then Bankwest came out with their rate tracker, which was an introductory rate loan product offering a 1% discount off the SVR. These were extraordinary things back in that period of time. As the mortgage broker industry started to get more market share, it created more competition. It also created more desire to increase discounts to attract more broker clients to the banks, and so on to this point in time where we're now getting as much as 3.1% discounts off the SVR. And that's been a good thing for overall customers. It's only good if you've actually been using a broker, or you've been negotiating with your bank or going to a new bank in the last, let's say, 10 or 15 years. If you haven't, and let's say you've just happily sat on a 1.3% interest rate discount thinking that that was great, because it was at the time, it's not great anymore. And you didn't get the benefit of all those rate decreases during the COVID period, like everyone else that maybe refinanced or took up a fixed rate option. So, you know, there's definitely a need to review. And that's just one example of how you are paying a loyalty tax if you did not refinance or negotiate with your bank in the last 5 to 7 years.
It's crazy. And so it is, you know, a one-man broker might not be able to access that same sort of discounting. There is a lot of leverage, I guess, that you might bring to the table with talking with these lenders. Would that be correct?
Yeah, well, the more loans we write, Jacob, the reality is the more rate discounts we see. So we have a real intimacy of seeing at any one point in time, day by day, what are the best rates being offered out there. Now, the lenders, at any point in time, they're always needing to write more lending. That's shareholder demand, it's business forecasts, it's the targets they need to achieve. So they need to pull levers. Now, banks are not great at building long-term sustainable relationships, which are very intimate around providing the advice, not providing you the sort of goals and how to get there. The reason being is you're never really going to deal with the same person for more than a year or two. That's just the reality and the workforce nature that they have now. And so, but you can have a lot longer lasting relationship with your broker or your advisor or your investment lending manager. And then when you mix that with them having a real awareness of what is great pricing and what should be the best price for you and what you have and what you can offer a lender, then you've got a powerful mix of factors occurring. So we can really demand the best pricing for our clients because we know what is the best pricing at any one point in time with any lender that's out there. If you're a one-man band, you might not have that sort of volume to be able to always see what's the best out there, what's always going to be the best thing going on.
Sort of looking over here while it's all happening over here, yeah.
Yeah, yep. But also, you know, a lot of the best rates occur from a pure discounting perspective. It's not a product with a built-in discount. That's what a lot of the sort of one-man bands, when you think about best interest rating and needed to sort of provide comparable loans, they might go to a selection panel website like, you know, CanStar or, you know, Rate City, and it's going, okay, the best rate for this sort of product looks like this. And that's generally an advertised discounted rate on one of their basic products. okay, and it doesn't have the feature of an offset. Okay, it does. But that's not going up to a bank and saying, listen, we've got a scenario. Yeah, we've got a $2 million loan facility. We've got a client who's potentially wanting some more lending in the future. It's a really sort of high income earning client, or they're really stable at making their repayments, and we want to get the best discount. What can you offer us? And that's where the real bargaining happens, and that's where the big discounts are actually come out.
Love it. So obviously we're not living in a bubble. We've got interest rates that have been increasing the last few months. It might start slowing down in the next few months as well, and who knows, potentially even retracing and coming backwards, you know, with reductions towards the back half of the year. This is all speculation. With this all in mind, the current environment, Damien, what do you see as the most compelling reasons to buy now?
Well, right now there's some really, I think, important factors in a couple of geographic locations, which you probably know a hell of a lot more about. But the mining sector is definitely going through a growth cycle again. And there's two states that predominantly, you know, caught up in a lot of that benefit, and that's WA and Queensland. And so, you know, and if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. You know, the mining sector is cyclic, just like any other sector. It goes through cycles. The peak of the mining boom occurred in 2007, early 2008, just before the Beijing Olympics. And commodity prices were creating a lot of that demand. But it was also a mixture of other reasons which created the mining boom, and that was it created a lot of jobs, particularly in WA. Property prices were nearing Sydney prices in Perth in the peak of the mining boom. And they've done absolutely nothing since the mining boom collapsed. And there's a reason for that too. You know, it's all about jobs and it's all about demand and demand for housing. The mining sector goes through two phases. Yeah, they go through investment, the creation of a new mine, the extension of a mine, the development of a new railway, the development of a new port. Yeah, and then they go into the production phase. And the production is very heavy machinery and very few workers. Yeah, it's big machines digging all the stuff out of the ground, putting it onto these big trains, and then some train driver driving a 5 mile or 5 kilometer long train full of raw commodity. Yeah, and then at the port, there's one or two guys on these big gantry cranes lifting it up and putting it on a ship. There's not a lot of labor needed, therefore all the jobs disappear. Now, that cycle, we've been in the production phase for around 15 years, which means at some point, the mine that they cut back 15 years ago needs, it's run out of supply. They've got to either extend it or, guess what? Go out and create a new mine because the demand's there. So now we're seeing a lot of job creation because the whole mining sector is going through that next investment cycle. And that'll probably last for what, 3 to 5 years? Huge amounts of jobs, a huge influx of skilled workers are now moving into Queensland and WA. The demand for rental and property is higher than it's been for a long, long time. I think what vacancy rates in WA and Queensland are sub 2%, you know, for tenancies. And people are wanting to live there too and migrate for to capture some of that income from the whole sort of mining sector. So, you know, it's a perfect recipe of there's growing demand and not enough supply. And the reason there's not enough supply is in WA, it made no sense for developers to carve up and produce stock during a period where prices were doing absolutely nothing. And we're talking a decade or more. So, you know, why would developers go and invest in doing developments in WA the last 10 years when the prices were flat or static or not growing? So, you know, it made sense to go into the states that were seeing the growth, which was the eastern states. So I think right now, although there's increasing interest rates and a bit of pessimism and there's a bit of doom and gloom around, there are still real pockets of opportunity for investors if they broaden their horizons and work with experts such as yourself who can give a lot more advice around these geographic pockets where the forecast is for increasing demand and less stock.
Well, I think it's you know, we it's definitely markets within markets. We're not investing in shares of Australian property, which, you know, would be an interesting product, but it's definitely been able to stack, you know, the push and pull of states and cities against each other to find that opportunity. And, you know, I know of I was investing in 2007, 2008, and I didn't go down the whole mining path. And I can remember sitting there going, hang on a second, maybe I should do it, and looking at the cover story of property magazines at the time, and there was all these faces plastered over there with all the money being made in all, you know, the Gladstones of the world and the crazy rental returns, and I was so tempted to do it. And obviously, it's a very cyclic, high volatility, high risk way of looking at the investment market. And I think You know, the markets that you're mentioning, Queensland and WA, and it's probably outside the scope of this conversation, but they have gone through a period of diversification. You know, whilst, as you say, and I haven't really heard the mining industry described as you have in terms of the depth of understanding that you have. It's, you know, you might be in the wrong industry by the sounds of it, Damien, but it shows a really awesome understanding of how mining fits together and works. I would think that the last, you know, Perth as an example, the last 10 years in the wilderness through the mining recovery, as you say, the production phase of mining, well, the state government have just been really investing very heavily across making Perth a world-class city, you know, really investing a lot of that money that's been made over there in the last little while into the city itself and bring lifestyle factors to the equation. So now, even though we're going through an investment phase in the mining industry once again, there is a diversified economy to back it up, I feel.
And that's adding fuel to the demand cycle. And that's what we're seeing too. You know, in Queensland, for example, it's not all mining centric. You know, they've got 10-year period now of pre-Olympics. And they're also very diversified. And there's a lot more that's actually now making up the broader economy of the state of Queensland, much the same as WA. So, I mean, these are very important areas. But it's just one opportunity or two opportunities that exist across Australia. I think the point I'm trying to make is, even though interest rates are increasing, right now is still a great time to be thinking about what you should be investing in. And I'm always reminded and I'm fascinated by the old sayings of Warren Buffett. Be fearful when people are greedy and greedy when people are fearful. In other words, what he's really trying to say is you buy in the gloom so that you can sell it in the boom. And he's the perfect person who understands everything is cyclic. The share market is cyclic. Property sectors are cyclic. You know, workforce sectors are cyclic. Technology will be cyclic. There will be different pockets of technology that go through cycles. You know, so these are where people who can understand that things are cyclic, who can then sort of read a little bit into the sort of broader aspects of what's creating the cycles, they have the ability to foresee some of these events. They don't know exactly. Warren Buffett will never say that he knew exactly when the bottom of the market was reached, but he knew when it was roughly there. And he knew instinctively that it was going to increase at some point in time. So, you know, people keep their powder dry for a very important reason. They look for these sorts of times where people are pessimistic, where there is a bit of hesitancy. Yeah, and they're definitely not going in and buying heavy when people are really optimistic and overpaying for assets.
And I think I'm very familiar with that saying, and I think it's a really good way to approach things. And it's not to say let's run out and go crazy, let's run out and buy anything for the sake of the market being down or the doom and gloom. You know, let's just load up. But it's a bias. You know, it's probably, you know, when people are very bullish, your response potentially should be, hang on a second, do I agree with them? You know, are things a little bit heated here, and what's going to be the next 6 months looking like? And by the same token, when things are doom and gloom, when you see the media cycle as doom and gloom, stopping and thinking, hang on a second, does this mean that there is fear in the market? And what we're looking for as investors is fear. That vendor who's happy to take another $10,000 or $15,000 off the price because I don't know what's going to be happening next week or next month. Well, we're acting with logic and reason and a longer term perspective than them. And we might have the luxury of a longer term perspective than them. So being able to, capitalize on that fear, I think it's really important. But it's not about going out and doing anything crazy or investing just for the sake of investing.
It absolutely has to be tailored and suited to the risk appetites of each individual, you know. But what we know is it's now becoming the investor market. When it was a very buoyant property market during COVID, that was not a buyer's market from an investor's perspective. Why? Because every time you went to go and buy a property or an auction, it was always exceeding the expected forecast range. And that meant there was a lot more emotionally invested buyers that wanted to purchase that property. And they emotionally invested to the point where they were happy to pay the extra 50 or 100,000, in some cases more, to secure the property. Yeah, because it was a lot more of an emotional sort of decision rather than a real dollars and cents investment-based decision. So investors were largely caught out of the market, or else they would have been overpaying. And an investor knows what they should be paying to make all the numbers work. And so we didn't see as much activity in the investor circles throughout 21 and 22, but we're now noticing that it's investors who are making up a lot of our inquiry. It's the investors that are understanding that now's probably the time where it's much more on my terms as a buyer to actually get the property at the price that I think it's worth, that I need it to come in at to make my investment strategy work better for me. So, you know, we tailor that very much to the needs and the appetites and the risk profile of the client to ensure that we're not really trying to persuade a client to do something. We're just giving them the facts. We're giving them the sort of experience that we have, and we're giving them the right sort of strategies that enables them to make these sorts of decisions with experts such as yourself.
I love it. It's very good. With this in mind, Damien, and you know, where you're sitting each day and the conversations that you're having, you know, your understanding of finance and the banking background, what do you see as potentially the strongest opportunity for investors? You know, how can they potentially access property or something that's potentially not really used as often or understood as well as it should be?
Yeah, look, the SMSF market is very much one of those at the moment, and you have to go back and understand a bit about the SMSF market. Back in 2007, banks didn't really lend to SMSFs. It was a relatively new concept. It was untested. It was untried. Untried in the courts, that is, from a recourse or a repossession perspective. It's actually a non-recourse loan, which means you can't actually foreclose on it in that sense, because it's super fund. There's a super fund legislation.
Oh, I didn't actually know that.
Banks became a bit more comfortable with the idea of lending to a super fund because it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense, particularly because you've almost got guaranteed income going into the fund through super contributions. Yeah, that's legislated. You know, you're employed, X amount of your salary goes into your super fund. So there's a guaranteed
income. So it's not like someone buys an investment property and they've got all this wonderful income and then they suddenly decide to stop paying the mortgage repayments and go on a holiday. They're not covering that shortfall, they're not covering the shortfall between the rent and the repayments. They've chosen other things. Where what you're saying, probably just going back at a quick level as well, Damien, self-managed super funds, you know, the vast majority of Australians have their money in a public super fund. And you can obviously move that back and forth. You know, you might go with Host Plus and then you might change jobs and go with another super provider. What we're talking about is you're forming your own super fund, right? It's a private, it can be you, it can be your spouse. It's a private fund where you are then using that. You know, you take your super out of Host Plus and you put it into your bank account that for your super, self-managed super fund. And then with that money, you're able to then go and buy investment properties. And then your super fund now has direct ownership of property. And so what you're saying there is if the super fund didn't pay the loan repayments, then the banks can't or have no recourse of repossession.
Yeah, there's a lot more litigation that needs to occur. It's the simple instrument of a mortgage to be able to repossess the property is a lot more complicated, and it's a lot more, entwined with other legal legislation to simply just be able to go where foreclosing and repossess. And so there are avenues for a lender, but it's a lot more complicated, and it's not all very legally tested out just yet. So, for example, a lender could wish to foreclose, have a mortgage on a property, obviously look to repossess the property or from the super fund, because the super fund is the owner, and then be caught up in a whole manner of other super fund legislation before they ever get close to trying to go through that. So that's the untested element. And so as we got closer to the Banking Royal Commission, banks opted out of the SMSF loan market, the major banks, that is, because of the foreseen complications if there were distressed clients or if there were issues that arose out of the Royal Commission related to self-managed super fund lending. And they opted out because they didn't really have a good understanding legally just how messy that could get. And so by rights, they decided to no longer offer those sorts of products. And that's their choice. They're allowed to do that. But what it did do was there was a lot of customers who took up SMSF lending in that lead up to 2018. And so they didn't have the ability to actually.
If you could just pause there, sorry, Damien, we've just had an internet dropout. All right, so thank you for the change of scenery, Damien. I think we just missed you there with the discussion around the self-managed super funds and the tier one lenders. So they essentially exited the market heading into the Banking Royal Commission, and they, you know, really left, I guess, the self-managed super funds high and dry. Would that be an accurate description? And where have things gone to in the loan market for self-managed super funds
since? They did leave them high and dry. You know, they did actually not pass on any of the discount benefits. And as I was just saying before, you know, the bankers within the banks are not allowed to actually request pricing discounts on these grandfathered SMSF products. So it's very, very rare to be able to negotiate an interest rate on your existing SMSF loan. Not great for a customer, and there's not a lot of options out there, or there hasn't been for some time.
So that means you've got a self-managed super fund, you've got a property that was purchased in that, say, 10 years ago. That's on a higher interest rate, an older product. Then the Banking Royal Commission happened, etc. And you're essentially stuck at that higher rate. There's no real discounting that occur on that. You know, and I think you mentioned last week as well, you know, some of those loans, some of those properties owned under those loans are on 9.5% interest rate as of right now.
Yeah, and there's a real reason to why that happened. We talked about SVRs, you know, the standard variable rate, and how they didn't reduce during the COVID era when the RBA was dropping rates, how the banks were only increasing their front book discounting. Okay, now if you're on a SMSF loan, you're on the standard variable rate plus a product margin. There was a risk associated to the non-recourse loan, so it was the standard variable plus maybe 20 basis points, maybe 60 basis points. Now, if you were sitting at around about 5.6%, because that was the SVR plus the product margin, okay, and now the interest rates have started going up, they've gone up over 3%. So you do the math, you're on well over 8.5% to 9.5%, depending on what your actual rate was before the rate increases.
Before that. So, I mean, I guess let's go back a step. You've got traditional, you've got investors with properties in their self-managed super funds, they're paying a high interest rate. Can those guys go and refinance their existing loan on those self-managed super fund properties?
Well, there wasn't a lot of options available to clients, and clients did not understand what options were available because it's not in your sort of traditional main bank sector. But there are a lot of specialist lenders now, non-bank lenders, who are actually now seeing the opportunity that exists for clients that are already existing, but clients that are wanting to look at the new purchase within an SMSF structure, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, and from an investor point of view, it can be quite beneficial to your overall strategy. So, you know, as some of these newer lenders have emerged with quite a lot of funding at their disposal and a lot better interest rates from a competitive point of view, we're seeing some interest rates still as low as 5.99%. Now, you compare that to a client who has an already established, already funded SMSF loan at, let's say, 9%, it doesn't take a lot to realise that you're going to be a lot better off. Now, there are some added costs associated with refinancing because you need to have obviously your trust and your bare trust to the super fund in place. There's an application cost and there's legal fees. So it's about $2,000 to $3,000. Traditionally in the banks, it was costing about $4,500 to establish an SMSF when they were first done. So there is a cost associated, but then you weigh up, what is it going to save me on the lower interest rate over the next 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? And you realize very quickly that it's still very much in your favor to review that.
And so that's, so I guess there is hope for those of you that own properties in self-managed super funds paying higher interest rates now. You know, Damien's talked about loan products that he's, you know, working closely with and has access to that can refinance that down to sub 6%, I guess, for the right lender, for the right applicant, the right property. But for those investors or for those people that have got money in super, and I think potentially even dormant money, they have $500,000 sitting there in their super account, or $300,000, and they are at the mercy of the super funds, whether they go up or down in value, they can't control that. So, what I guess you're talking about is going out and using that money in your super fund as a deposit to then purchase with the bank's money a property within that super fund. And I think the probably just at a high level from a strategic point of view, we're always looking at, I guess, capital growth and return on investment yield. Where super funds work really well is, and you touched on it before, Damien, you are forced to contribute cash flow to it anyway. Whilst you are still working, your employer is paying income, super contributions, into your self-managed super fund. And it is generally a longer time horizon. So typically we've found it's a very strong strategy with clients to purchase very high capital growth assets. And with higher interest rates as they are now, you know, sub 6% there for self-managed super funds still, it might be okay to wear a little bit in terms of cash flow each week, you know, negative cash flow in the investment with no compromise on the capital growth fundamentals of the asset, because it is a longer time horizon, knowing that you will be having those guaranteed super contributions buffering that shortfall per week. I think that's where we really have an aha moment when we have this conversation with clients, because they're like, hang on a second, I'm covering that shortfall anyway through my wages and I have to make that self-managed super fund contribution. I want a property that is uncompromised, growth, growth, growth. Is that what you're seeing in terms of some of the guys that you're talking to, Damien, or have you got anything to add to that?
You've got to think about it. What's the whole idea of a self-managed super fund? It's you taking control of the funds management. Your job as the funds manager is to actually maintain and get the best return possible year on year on year on. What you're actually doing is you're saying, I'm going to not leave it to someone in the industry fund to worry about, who's going to probably get me an 8 to 10% return on average over the next 10 years. You're going to say, well, you know, I think I can do a better job of it. Yeah, that's why I'm going to sort of consult.
8 to 10%? Gee, that sounds like a good one.
That's what they've generally been performing. Last year was probably a bit of a doozy, and that's already coming back up this year. So the industry funds are not that bad, don't get me wrong. You know, there's a low-cost fee structure, and they can generate a pretty decent return year on year on. The self-managed super fund is designed for those that are a lot more sophisticated. They understand that there are probably opportunities. There's also risks associated with higher returns. So risk and return are very interlinked, these two things. But they're prepared to maybe take some of that risk. Maybe they want to determine their own diversification. So whatever it is, the structure, if it's property they're looking for, they're obviously looking at it two things. Yeah, it's got to have a yield return, because I need to generate a return on an investment, or else I just simply leave the money sitting with an industry fund and I'll get a return, 8% or year, or whatever that adds up to be, depending on the fund. And then they're saying, okay, but there's another added element you pointed on, which is the equity growth. So some really good investments in superannuation come down to two types, residential or commercial. Commercial, typically, you know, has a high yield return, not a lot of capital growth. But these are pretty expensive properties to buy in the first place, and they generally sell for a fair bit later on down the track. They don't maybe make as much growth over the actual equity cycle over time, but they're making much stronger yield returns. But there is a risk associated too. You can have longer periods of vacancy with a commercial property.
For me, I think it needs to come back to the individual, and this is just my two cents, I guess, in terms of what types of assets in super funds, because, you know, if you're 40, if you're 30, you might have 25, 35 years until you do retire, and you don't really need the passive income in your self-managed super fund. You've not been able to access that passive income anyway. With that longer time horizon, you just want to be at 65, you know, buying a $500,000 investment now, and you want compounding on compounding on compounding on compounding. So in 35 years, that $500,000 investment might be worth $3.5-4 million, and that's equity. And then potentially when you're getting closer to that retirement age, you are 60, you might take that equity in your super fund and convert that into really high cash flow producing assets, you know, buying that larger ticket commercial asset, which is issuing you, you know, cash over cash over cash every week. Not much growth, or not as much growth, but huge cash flows. And so then you've essentially use that equity you've built up over many years with a longer time horizon, with a focus on capital growth, and you've turned that into higher cash flow that's funding your retirement. And you potentially could be in a position where you don't have to sell either of those assets. You can have that cake and eat it too. And that would be a holy grail type scenario where you do have all of the assets retained in the super fund and your own personal portfolio as well. And you can bundle that up and send it down the line to the kids or the kids' kids as a, you know, well-rounded portfolio.
It's definitely got its strategic benefits. You know, the traditional super funds or the platform funds, the industry funds, they're not thinking about that sort of life cycle stage. They think about it more in just preserving your balance. Okay, so as you get closer to retirement, they're going to dial down the risk, dial down the return, but preserve more of the balance. You might not agree to that. You might go, look, the timing means that it's still really buoyant in the market. I want to keep it going that way. So hence why people elect to think about developing and starting their own self-managed super fund. From a lending perspective and lending strategy, it makes a lot of sense, you know, because you talked about how can people access extra borrowing power. Self-managed super funds don't take into account all of your personal debts or your non-deductible debts. What it looks at is the super fund as its own entity. And it says, okay, what's the income going into the fund? What are the expenses of the fund? Well, it's not supporting anyone and their living costs. Yeah, the super fund doesn't have living costs. It just has its debt obligations if it has any. And so there, and then it's, you know, it's accounting obligations every year for auditing. So there's not a lot of costs. So you've got income, guaranteed, you know, superannuation payments from your, you know, PAYG income goes into it, and you might have rental income. So now you've got income, and then you've got the debt repayment. And it's a very, very simple servicing calculation without all the mess of responsible lending, without all the mess of my credit card limits and, you know, how much I spend on beef Wagyu steaks every Friday night or if anything like that, as we heard in some of the commentary. You know, it really is
or,
a simple,
yeah, or Uber Eats
correct,
sitting
so
there.
It's a
yeah.
very simple equation. You have the elective benefit of being able to add extra money into your super fund. Yeah, you also have liquidity in your fund, which is the cash reserves that are already saved up in it, or other liquid assets like shares that are easily sellable. And so therefore, you're right, you do have already potential for a deposit, and you do have a lot more servicing bargaining within the super fund itself, because it doesn't have to worry about living expenses and other associated non-deductible debts. And every bit of interest on that super fund through a loan is deductible because it's an investment strategy.
I love it. So all fees payable, you know, consulting fees, advocacy fees, agent fees, all of this is all able
Absolutely.
To be paid from the self-managed super fund. So, you know, let's say the sweet spot we're already seeing opportunity at the moment in the country is probably between 400 and 650,000. That's where we're seeing these markets really starting to show a lot of strength. Let's say someone was wanting to buy a $500,000 investment in their self-managed super fund. What sort of balance would they need to have in the super fund? Because, as mentioned, you do have leverage involved. What would the super fund balance need to be, essentially, to be able to buy that $500,000 asset?
Well, I personally think you need to be sensible about these things. You've got to have for economic sense, it's got to have a certain balance in any way, because there are auditing costs, okay? So have your accountant provide you your audit certificate, undertake your tax return on the super fund. They've got to audit every sort of investment line that's within the fund itself. If you've got shares, so on and so forth, they've got to look at all the statements. It's not cheap. Yeah, it's about minimum of $2,000 a year, probably a little bit less, probably a little bit more, depending on what's within the super fund for the average person. Now, you compare that to what you're going to pay in fees at a platform or industry fund, okay, you're probably paying $600 to $800 a year. So your fund, by general rule of thumb, has to have a minimum balance of around about $400,000 in it. Now, if you're buying a property and you're needing a minimum of, let's say, a 20 or 30% deposit for a super fund loan product, you can get lenders now, non-bank lenders, that are looking at 80% LVRs on SMSF products. The banks were typically around about the 65 or 70 at the most back in the time when they were doing it. But, you know, if you think about it at 80%, for example, you're going to need to throw in the 20% plus costs, your buyer's advocacy costs, stamp duty, other buying costs, you know, all those things factored in. And you need to have some sort of residual balance left over, sensible residual balance. You can't just throw all your eggs into one basket, because if that property doesn't perform, you've really hampered and you've damaged your potential superannuation retirement benefit later on. So you need to be sensible.
So they like to see that oversight.
Absolutely. But you know, you could have maybe $100,000 or $150,000 of cash left over after the purchase, borrow the rest, then that's the ideal sort of situation. You know, a loan of, let's say, you bought something for $500,000, you have to throw in $100,000 plus a little bit on top, call it $120,000 all up, and you had $300,000 in the fund, well, you've got $180,000 left over in cash. And that's liquidity outside of your property purchase. And that allows you to think about, okay, well, my property has now grown in value, and there's a bit more asset value in there, I might go and buy another one. And you've already got cash funds available, plus you've been throwing money in through your super contributions and the rent income.
So you are able to refinance that property in the super fund and access that equity in the same way that potentially under your personal name?
You are able to go around that because of the original investment strategy and purchase. But remember, it is a fund, it is an investment vehicle. and it was all about gearing up your assets to be able to invest more. The lending itself is a little bit more complicated because it's a little bit outside of the appetite for some lenders, but that's dependent on the lender policies that they have. Some may allow you to do small increases or cash outs on that equity. They might allow you to sort of, if it's all done under the same bear trust and so on and so forth, they may allow you to cross collateralize and join up the equity so you can leverage it for the next purchase as well.
Beautiful. And just another question that came to mind as well, can you combine, say, yours and your spouse's self-managed super funds together? So you might have both have 200,000?
That's a very common scenario. So, you know, let's just say in traditional nuclear family, you've got a husband and a wife, and husband has 200,000 in super, wife has 200,000 in super, they elect to amalgamate their two platform or retail funds into one self-managed super fund. They're both trustees of the trust, or they are the directors of the corporate trustee for the trust. These days, the lenders that are doing SMSF lending only really will do it to corporate trustee structures where there's a company acting as the trustee for the SMSF trust.
Yes. Yeah. It's really opened my eyes. It's I think it's definitely something that it needs to complement an overall strategy, and potentially, you know, you might be focused more on particular type of property in your personal names, and then with a different time horizons associated with when your retirement age, etc., a more aggressive capital growth or cash flow strategy within the self-managed super fund, they could complement each other really well. And you know, for those of you that don't like taking the bull by the horns, potentially it might be something that suits
one
your
example
approach
we're seeing
to allocating
now,
capital.
Jacob, just on the SMSF, and then we'll no doubt wrap up on that. You know, if you think about the traditional sort of investor client, you know, maybe they've got one or two properties in their personal names, and they're doing that predominantly for negative gearing benefits, okay? But now they've reached with their increasing interest rates and the buffers that are applied by the banks, maybe they're capped out on their servicing because of cost of living, because of non-deductible debts, and they're no longer able to invest, but they know that there's good buying opportunities. So they potentially elect to amalgamate and create a self-managed super fund. And in the nuclear family, husband and wife do that, they have a $400,000 balance. The super fund isn't capped out in a servicing sense by all their other existing debts in their personal names. So the super fund potentially goes on. Now, if you think about my longer term strategy of having 4-5 investment properties so that when I do retire, I've got, you know, quite a few more. And I was reading an article today in The Australian about how many investment properties do you need to comfortably retire now? And it used to be one or two, and it's now probably tending to be 3 or 4. Because of cost of living increases and the age at which we're living. So, you know, if you think about that and you're sort of stuck, you don't necessarily need to be stuck from buying property. And the SMSF becomes that sort of option where you can continue to invest in property, but not necessarily be hamstrung by the fact that the banks no longer allow me to borrow more money, even though I've got the cash flow to do it, because of these serviceability buffers that are applied. So they're assessing you on 8.5%. And you might have an interest-only strategy of 5 years interest-only, and I look to liquidate that property. That might be part of the strategy. But the bank will forecast your repayments on principal and interest over the next 30 years and put that into the servicing equation. And then your rent income. They might say, well, look, you know, we're only going to give you 80% of the rent income. We have to shade it to be sensible and conservative. But then you've got rental property costs, so we're going to shade it by another 20%. So you're only left with, out of the $2,000 a month that you make in rent income, we're only going to give you 60% of that in the servicing equation. So we're not going to give you all the income, and we're going to massively increase all your expenses. And if you've got the capacity to borrow any more, good luck to you. That's what's happening relatively now. But the SMSF doesn't have to worry about all those entanglements.
It's look, it's absolute gold. I think it's just an eye-opener to show that there are other ways. And I think this is a sophisticated, you know, an investment strategist, a finance investment strategist, and not necessarily a broker. This is a conversation that you know, we can see that there are potentially other vehicles, other ways.
Now, I must disclaim, Jacob, in all honesty, we don't provide advice in relation to what you should do. We provide what is the lending scenario that you're able to achieve. So it's very important to distinguish. You know, it could be seen to say that maybe we are providing advice in relation to you should go out and set up a super fund. We'll never do that. You know, people need to come to those own conclusions first. They need to be advised by their advisors.
It's a very good point.
That's an appropriate structure for them and what they're hoping to achieve. What we will do as an investment lending specialist is allow them to understand what are the lending options they can actually look to obtain. And how does that fit in with the overall strategy we're looking to do? It's very important to distinguish that we will never provide advice on what you should do. We will help you understand what's the smart way to use money and lending products to suit your strategy.
And I think it's a chicken and egg type scenario, Damien, where, you know, if people don't know what is possible, and this is a conversation where we, you know, I didn't know what was possible. Some of the things that you've said today, I'm like, hang on a second, that's a, you know, that's, you know, definitely a very deep layer of understanding and knowledge. That needs to be explained to people so they do know what is possible. Then they can go away and form their own conclusions and then come back and be facilitated into whatever they determine is possible.
We give people ideas that they may be unaware of yet. Doesn't necessarily mean that we'll provide them the final advice on that, but we will provide them with options and ideas that can enable a broader wealth enablement strategy. Because of our sort of breadth of experience and expertise. And then, yeah, like you said, then they go away and they speak to their specialist. I heard about this, and does it fit what I was thinking? Because, you know, I didn't really know that that existed, but is it something that suits me? And their advisor, whether it be their accountant or financial planner, says, look, that is something you can absolutely look at doing. And then they come back and ask us how they do
it. And their specialist might not know about it either, mate. Like, their specialist, their accountant, their financial planner might not know this is possible either, you know, because you are doing what you're best at. You're focusing on your core competency as a, you know, property investment advisor or a buyer's agent or advocacy business. We're just focusing on the property, you know, in terms of the accountant or the financial planner might not see and be at the coalface in terms of the finance side of the equation. So I think it definitely needs to be a chicken and egg and an informational conversation. But I think what's evident to me is the depth of knowledge that you and you definitely have, and I'd love to continue the conversation with Timely Matters as well, Damien, into the future, coming onto the podcast and talking. But ALIC, I've seen the wonderful work that you do with our clients that we've warmly introduced to you, and a very safe space, I think, and a lot of comfort that it's given to me, knowing that our clients are coming to you for assistance and help. And I might put in the show notes, Damien, a link to how best to contact you and potentially, you know, members of your team directly. And where that fits into the picture they're looking at going. Would that be
absolutely
okay?
It's great. You know, we've got an expanding presence across the East Coast, and now we've got people located in the West Coast of Australia. We're supported by a large overseas workforce that, you know, assists our teams to do a lot of the processing work that's associated. So, you know, we're a business with over 80 people at the moment and expanding all the time. So definitely reach out to us. You'll see a lot of the different people that we have that are experts in their own field, from medical specialists to legal professionals to, you know, ultra high net worth clients. And so there's a full complement of people that you can obviously connect with besides myself.
Love it. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on and sharing all the takeaways from what's going on in finance,
Damien.
No problem.
Thanks for having me on board, Jacob. And thanks to you and Ripehouse for always looking after our clients so well.